Good afternoon and welcome to a Juno Afternoon for Wednesday, the 2nd of March, the year 2016. I'm Jeff Brown, I'm your host for today. We'll be learning about Saturday's community celebration on the anniversary of the Tongass Timber Reform Act. We'll get a preview of tonight's Wildlife Wednesday presentation with biologist Heidi Pearson and how marine mammals help combat climate change. Larry Johansson will be here to highlight his new book, Finding Juno, and we'll talk with Christy West, one of Aware's women of distinction this year. That writer's almanac, Burr Note, music and more today on a Juno Afternoon. Weather forecast for tonight, mostly clear skies with low temperatures around 26 degrees. Forecast for Thursday, increasing clouds with a chance of rain and snow in the afternoon. Thursday night, mostly cloudy skies and mostly cloudy skies expected for Friday.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Leaders from 20 organizations across Alaska's North Slope have joined together to form a new nonprofit corporation. As Emily Schwing reports, they've come together with a goal to increase representation for the people of the region.
For years, leaders of various organizations, including tribal councils, regional Native corporations, and even state and federal government, have gathered to discuss job creation, policy development, and other issues in the Arctic. Teresa M. works in policy support for Arctic Slope Regional Corporation.
The people of the North Slope felt that they weren't adequately being included in all of the Arctic discussions.
She says outside organizations try to assist the region's small communities, but often their help is ineffective because they don't understand the challenges of life in the remote Arctic.
Discussions about the science or traditional knowledge or subsistence impacts or community impacts or economic impacts should be generated from the local voice, not from an outside voice.
And that's what Voice of the Arctic Inupiat is set up to do. It's a new nonprofit corporation. Rex Rock is the president and CEO of Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, based in Barrow. He's also the board chairman of Voice of the Arctic.
All the groups came together and said, you know, we need to speak as one because when we're out whaling, when we're out hunting, when we're out doing things, we work as one. You speak as one together and more entities, it's going to carry more weight.
For now, members of Voice of the Arctic will focus on making sure member communities understand the organization's purpose. I'm Emily Schwing in Nome.
A Native American-owned newspaper based in Martin, South Dakota, has become the first weekly paper in the state to offer a mobile app to its readers. As Jim Kent reports, the small-town publication already has a number of social media followers.
The Lakota Country Times is the largest Lakota-owned and operated independent color newspaper. Publisher Connie Smith feels the reason for her paper's popularity is its content.
There's been newspapers out there that would always do negative stories. We felt like, okay, that information's already out there, so we've always done positive.
So whether it's Who Won a Spelling Bee or photos from a local powwow, Connie Smith wants her readers to know about it. The Lakota Country Times does cover controversial topics, adds Smith, but they're not the paper's primary focus. Once she saw the publication's Facebook numbers growing and comments from followers around the world, Smith knew it was time for the next technological step, a mobile app.
Facebook numbers have really gone through the roof because it's the ease of the app that you can put the app on your phone, and anybody that wants to follow what we're doing, all they have to do is click on there.
With nearly 200,000 followers, the Lakota Country Times outdistances competitors like News from Indian Country and Native Sun News 20-fold. But no matter how much her paper grows, Connie Smith assures her readers across the country and around the world that the Lakota Country Times will remain a community-based newspaper. For National Native News, I'm Jim Kent.
A Cherokee Nation woman is named leader of the Indian Health Service. Mary Smith will serve as principal deputy and be responsible for duties of director. Smith joined the agency in 2015 and has worked on behavioral health, Native youth initiatives, and other issues. She served as the primary IHS liaison to other federal agencies. Smith is taking over for Robert McSwain, who stepped down to spend more time with his family. The staff announcement was made Tuesday in a letter to Indian Health Service employees from Secretary of Health and Human Services, Sylvia Burwell. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. And by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C.
If you or a loved one suffer from alcohol addiction, hear how recovery is possible from those who've had their day one at nativenews.net.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's 6 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned to a June afternoon. Our first guests are Patricia Weary from the Southeast Chapter of the Alaska Wildlife Association Alliance and biologist Heidi Pearson talking about blue carbon. Thank you very much for coming down the station today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having us.
So before we go too much further, Patricia, could you tell us about the Southeast Alaska Wildlife Alliance?
All right. So the main organization is located in Anchorage. It's the Alaska Wildlife Alliance. We're the Southeast Chapter, and down here in Southeast, we focus on education, and we provide the Wildlife Wednesdays that happen about 6-7 times during the winter. And this is our last program with the speaker that we have visiting today.
In the studio is Heidi Pearson, Assistant Professor of Marine Biology at University of Alaska Southeast. Your topic is called blue carbon. Can you elaborate on that, please?
Sure. Well, blue carbon is an emerging topic that scientists have been investigating more in depth, I would say, for about the past 5 years. And it refers to how marine organisms can help in trapping, storing, and sequestering carbon, and ultimately might be able to help combat some of the effects of climate change.
How long has this been theorized?
It has, like I said, the first published papers came out around 2010, and those papers referred to part of what I'll be talking about tonight, which is called the whale pump. And so I would say it's gained more scientific attention in the past 5 or 6 years.
How did you do your research?
Well, I use mostly behavioral methods to observe whales and their feeding behavior, and then we also use some other equipment, these scientific echo sounders, that will allow us to look at the prey field below the surface, and then also we do direct sampling of water, and then also for this project, we're actually looking at collecting whale fecal material or whale poop that we scoop up.
That sounds like a mouthful of scientific jargon.
Except the poop part.
Could you elaborate a little bit more on what do you mean by behavioral?
Sure. Well, we look at what the whales are doing on the surface. So are they resting? Are they feeding? Are they interacting with one another?
This isn't groundbreaking research, then.
Well, what we're doing is based on previous studies that have occurred in other parts of the world, such as in the Antarctic regions and off the northeast coast of the U.S., and we're looking at testing if these same principles apply to Southeast Alaska water. So, no, it's not a novel concept, but the novel concept is that no one has looked at it in our region of the world before.
I'd like to know more about how the whales can stop the carbon, the climate change.
Okay. Well, it's based on the idea that whale poop is really full of nutrients like nitrogen. So think of your garden, and you might put fertilizer in your garden that has nitrogen, and that helps the plants to grow. Well, the same type of thing happens in the ocean. If you add higher concentrations of nutrients, such as nitrogen, which we believe is high in the poop of whales, it will basically help to fertilize the surface waters. And what that will do is it will cause the algae to grow. And if there's more algae, there are small marine plants. So if we have more of these small marine plants, they will then help to suck up and absorb carbon dioxide from the atmosphere.
How many whales does it take to do all this miracle stuff?
Oh, my gosh. Well, that is a question that we don't know yet.
Do you ever go beneath the surface of the water to do your studies?
I personally don't, no.
This talk goes on tonight from 7 to 8 at the Valley Public Library. Anything you'd like to add?
Well, the other part of the story I'll be telling tonight is how sea otters also might be important in helping to alleviate some of the climate challenge. And they do this through feeding on sea urchins. Sea urchins feed on kelp. And if we have less kelp in the ocean, it means we have less marine plant life. Again, less marine plant life that might help to suck up carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. So if we have sea otters keeping the sea urchin population low, this, we think, will help the kelp forest to flourish and then help in sucking up more of that carbon dioxide from the atmosphere.
And all this will be accompanied by pictures and graphs.
That's right.
Did you have anything else to say?
Yes, this is our very last one of our seasons. We're going to be around next fall. And I would like to do a thank you to KTOO. We fish for people to come and receive this education provided to them in an interesting fashion. And you are one of the baits that we put on our hook. And thank you also.
I won't take that personally.
Well, you know, you do. It's your enthusiasm that is the bait and putting this out on the air. Thank you also to the Empire and to the library. We've switched over to using the library, so it's a very desirable place. And we thank all those folks.
All right, thanks, Patricia Weary and biologist Heidi Pearson. Thanks for coming down the station today.
Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 2nd of March, 2016. It's the birthday of Dr. Seuss, Theodore Seuss Geisel, born Springfield, Massachusetts, 1904, edited the humor magazine at Dartmouth, was kicked off the magazine for drinking gin in his room, but he kept writing for it under the pseudonym Seuss, his middle name, his mother's maiden name. He was a freelance cartoonist, an ad man, and on a ship coming home from Europe in 1936, he wrote a children's book, And to Think That I Saw It on Mulberry Street, rejected by 20 different editors, and then, walking along Madison Avenue, he ran into a Dartmouth classmate who worked at Vanguard Press, and they published it in 1937. Dr. Seuss said, if I'd been walking down the other side of Madison Avenue, I'd be in the dry cleaning business today. It's the birthday of John Irving, Exeter, New Hampshire, 1942, author of The World According to Garp, The Hotel New Hampshire, The Cider House Rules, novels influenced by the works of Charles Dickens. John Irving, who writes at an L-shaped desk surrounded by notepads and notebooks, writes by hand before typing. He said, one great advantage of writing by hand, in addition to how much it slows you down, is that it makes me write at the speed that I feel I should be composing rather than faster than I can think. It's the birthday of the novelist Tom Wolfe, Richmond, Virginia, 1931, author of The Bonfire of the Vanities, A Man in Fall, I Am Charlotte Simmons, and most recently Back to Blood, a story about Cuban immigrants in Miami. He said, the reason a writer writes a book is to forget a book, and the reason a reader reads one is to remember it. And it's the birthday of Sholem Aleichem, born in Pereyaslav, Ukraine, 1859, Yiddish language writer, son of a successful lumber merchant. His given name was Solomon Rabinowitz, but he adopted a pen name because his family disapproved of him writing in Yiddish rather than in Hebrew. Wrote many stories about Tevye, the milkman, which inspired the musical Fiddler on the Roof. Sholem Aleichem, who said, life is a dream for the wise, a game for the fool, a comedy for the rich, a tragedy for the poor. He said, no matter how bad things get, you got to go on living, even if it kills you. Died at the age of 57 in New York City. 100,000 mourners lined the streets on the day of his funeral. Here's a poem for today by Pat Schneider. Middle Age. The child you think you don't want is the one who will make you laugh. She will break your heart when she loses the sight in one eye and tells the doctor she wants to be an apple tree when she grows up. It will be this child who forgives you again and again for believing you don't want her to be born, for resisting the rising tide of your body, for wishing for the red flow of her dismissal. She will even forgive you for all the breakfasts you failed to make exceptional. Someday this child will sit beside you when you are old and too tired of war to want to watch the evening news. She will tell you stories like the one about her teenaged brother, your son, and his friends taking her out in a canoe when she was 5 years old, how they left her alone on an island in the river while they jumped off the railroad bridge. Poem Middle Age by Pat Schneider from Another River, New and Selected Poems, published by Amherst Writers Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Poetry Foundation, you can subscribe to the Poetry Magazine podcast and the Poetry Off the Shelf podcast in the iTunes Store or listen at poetryfoundation.org. And by Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving to calculate baseline scores. Learn more at lumosity.com. Engineered by Noah Smith, produced by Joy Biles. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Every Alaskan can make a difference when they file online for their PFD. Pick, Click, Give, a great and easy way to support nonprofits in Alaska. You simply donate during your PFD application process. There are dozens of nonprofits that you can support in Juneau alone, including KTOO Public Media. The application period for the PFD begins January 1st and runs through the end of March. More information can be found at pickclickgive.org.
17 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned to Juneau Afternoon. Our next guests in the studio are Riley Woodford and Bart Kohler here to talk about the 25th anniversary of the Tongass Timber Reform Act and the celebration that's happening this weekend. Thanks for coming down the station.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
So, Bart, if you could tell me about the act and what it's meant to Southeast Alaska and perhaps the world.
I need to go back in time a little bit, Jeff, when we both of us had a lot less gray hair than we do now. But back in 1980... the Alaska Lands Act was passed by Congress, and that was Admiralty Island was protected by that act. Misty Fjord, some of the great landmarks of Southeast Alaska were all protected. What came with that, however, was kind of the pound of flesh that Senator Ted Stevens took from the U.S. Congress, that in order to protect those lands, he created this huge subsidy for the pulp mills, the two giant pulp mills that existed in Ketchikan and Sitka. Subsidy of $40 million a year minimum to build roads and clear-cut Tongass. It had a hard timber target of 450 million board feet a year, and it kept propped up the 50-year contracts for these two giant mills by doing so. And basically, at that time in 1980, SEAC decided that was too much to bear, that we had to do everything we could in our power to try to save the last of the best watersheds, the salmon fisheries, salmon strongholds in Southeast Alaska, from what inevitably would be the juggernaut that would come and gobble up all the watersheds throughout Southeast Alaska that had standing, giant, vibrant forests. The act itself took 3 days short of a decade to be enacted. It basically repealed the Ted Stevens special language that was enacted in 80. It got rid of the automatic subsidy, which was costing the U.S. taxpayers up to $40 million, well more than $40 million a year, to do damage to salmon fisheries that were bringing in millions of dollars a year each and every year without any investment from the taxpayer. It got rid of the 450 million board foot timber target. It also modified the contracts of the two pulp mills. It didn't cancel the contracts, but by forcing the pulp mills to play by the rules that every other operator on the national forest throughout the country had to deal with, the pulp mills couldn't handle it without their subsidies and without the special rules that had been written in the 1940s to rebuild Japan, essentially, after World War II. We think by then, you know, by the 1980s, we probably had done enough to rebuild Japan, that the pulp mills eventually closed 6 years later. So that's the Ted Stevens part. The more remarkable part to me that goes with this sea change is the salmon strongholds that were protected by this legislation that people now maybe take for granted. They've been there for 25 years. I'm talking about world-class fisheries like Catashan River, like Lisianski River, like Trap Bay, like the Chuck River, like and further south, the Karta, Nutqua, Annan, Naha. All these great places, Point Adolphus, people go whale watching every year. That place has been protected. That's all due to the Tongass Timber Reform Act. And it's had a lasting landmark effect for Southeast Alaska. So it did cause a huge sea change. And right now, the amount of timber being cut on the Tongass is less than one-tenth of what was before this act was enacted 25 years ago.
Was it a difficult bill to get to Congress or an act?
Yeah. Yeah, it was thought to be impossible. And I think the one thing that made the huge difference was the bedrock grassroots heroes that are out there throughout Southeast Alaska of all walks of life, particularly commercial fishermen, and who rose to the occasion and stood up and spoke out for the places they loved, because they were... You had places outside of Tenneke that was their front yard or backyard, outside of Pelican, outside of Elfin Cove, outside of Huna, outside of Gustavus, outside of Heidelberg. Everywhere you turn, there were places that were special to people, and they knew that if the clock kept ticking and if Congress didn't change the law, that those lands were going to be lost eventually to the chainsaw and the bulldozer from the pulp mills. So it was a classic example of David and Goliath, and it's amazing that it was the grassroots folks here in Southeast Alaska that made all the difference.
And this weekend you're having a celebration.
Yeah, we thought it'd be better than having a stuffy conference. We thought we'd have a party, and so
that's the Alaskan way to do things.
Yeah, I think so. It's about time, and people might wonder why we're doing it in March instead of November, which was last year, which would have marked the official 25th, but it was all during the holiday season. It's hard to get people together, and so it's a bit of a lag time, but it's with spring and the weather that as it is right now, and I hope it stays this way, will be perfect. It's going to be at the Yacht Club, and it's going to be Saturday night, which is this Saturday night, March 5th, and there'll be a potluck at starting at 6 o'clock. We will have an anchor, what's known as an anchor dish or two, possibly some of that world famous secret recipe lemon crick lasagna that can be bought nearby. those people that are mainstays of Costco lasagna will recognize the shape and size, perhaps. The beer is also from the Lemon Crick location, from the famous world-class Alaskan brewery. There will be free food, free beer, free wine, free fun. There will also be toasts to the heroes of the Tongass, particularly the unsung ones that have done so much and have gotten so little praise over the years that are still out there in the hinterlands. And there will be a silent auction. We've got Ray Troll, you know, the world-famous Ray Troll. He couldn't come up with his ratfish band this time, but he is sending up a very special print that we're going to have for auction, and there'll be a couple other cool items like that. There'll be some maps for people to tell write stories on from their favorite places. And some of the toasts will be actually stories from local folks who'll be coming in from Penike or Gustavus or where have you. And there'll be photos and fun. And the main thing is to have fun and just sort of celebrate these special places and the special people that have brought their protection to bear for so long now.
Do you have any favorite places in Southeast?
Yeah, pretty much all of them. Yeah. Yeah.
Riley, how about you? Do you have a favorite place in Southeast Alaska?
Chuno.
Is it good?
Yeah. No, I like lots of places. I like Gustavus a lot.
There's all these watersheds are really special. I forgot to mention Berners Bay was one of the areas that was protected by the Tongass Timber Reform Act. And if you go bear watching around Wrangell at Annan, that was one of the areas that was protected. Salmon Bay Lake and Calder Holbrook and Idaho Inlet and Pleasant Island and Indian Islands and Lemassure Island, all these places are still intact because Congress had the foresight and Alaskans had the wisdom to go forth and do good things by a congressional act. So
it's all happening on Saturday, the celebration anyway.
Yeah, and we got a great band that's playing.
Susu and the Prophets. Yeah, we'll be playing after the toast and the stories, probably 7:45 or so, 8 o'clock, we'll start playing. We'll do play up till about 10:30. We'll have dance music. It'll all be dance music, rock and roll. And we're excited to be playing and to be playing at a venue like the Yacht Club. So we're not necessarily playing in a bar at 2 in the morning. This is something that people can come to. It's a little earlier in the evening. It's open to the public. Lots of good parking, right, at the Yacht Club. It's a pretty great venue, and it's going to be great to set up and play a couple hours of music for this event.
And what time does it all start?
It starts, the potluck starts at 6, and the music starts around 7:30, I guess, right around then. And these guys do a great job with letting it all hang out there, and it's set up for both. There are a bunch of us old graybeards now that'll be there, and hopefully we'll stay awake till 10 o'clock. And I'm getting word that more and more younger generation folks are going to be coming in because there hasn't been a real wild dance in quite a while. And the Yacht Club seems to be the spot to be headed for on Saturday night.
Yeah. Mark Golden and Riley Woodford, do you have anything to add that I forgot to ask?
No, thanks a lot for having us here.
Yep, thanks a lot, Jeff.
I was raised on The March Barn Dance is this Saturday, March 5th, 7:30 p.m. at St. Anne's Parish Hall, 5th Street, downtown. Uncle John's String Band will provide live music, and Odette Edgar will teach and call contra and square dances. No experience or partners are necessary. The steps are easy, the people are friendly, and the music is lively. Show up ready to dance and smile a lot. Discounts for students and seniors free for JVs and AmeriCorps, sponsored by Juno Folk Dancers with help from KTOO. Barn Dance, Saturday.
It's 31 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned to Juno Afternoon. I'm Jeff Friend. I'm your host for today. Our next guest in the studio is Larry Johansson. He's got a new book coming out, Finding Juno, Its People, Places, and Past. Larry, thank you for coming out.
Thanks for having me.
So, could you describe, it's a picture book.
Well, yes. There are over 100 pictures of Juno past and present, but it's also a storybook, and I wanted to focus on the history of Juno, but in an entertaining way, in a light way. So I think this book accomplishes that.
It's got mostly pictures, but a lot of great stories, and talks about the different areas like the glacier and the most famous man in the world.
Oh, the most interesting man in the world.
Can you tell me about that, please?
Well, that was a lot of the information that I derived from this book. For this book comes from my days working in the tourism field, in which we developed walking tours of downtown Juno and did a lot of original research for that, putting pieces of information together to come up with some really unique stories. So this, some of the stories that are in the book have never been heard before. And one of the most interesting stories that I came across was the story of the hockey player Joseph Whiteside Boyle. And he, if you were to write to make a movie on an interesting guy, he would fill the Hollywood script very nicely. He, too long to go into the story, but the book describes the story, but he definitely could win the title of the world's most interesting man. And he visited Juno on a couple of days. And the story of his interaction with Juno before the Klondike Gold Rush is fascinating. So I had to include that story amongst others in the book. But yeah, he was an interesting dude for sure.
What gave you the idea to do the book?
Well, to be honest, Jeff, I almost felt it was an obligation to write the book because I had all this information and it just didn't feel right that it didn't get out there. And with the collection of photographs that I first started coming to Juno when I was 14 from Ketchikan, 1970s, and it was taking photographs of Juno, I've got over 50,000 photographs. And with a combination of the research, of the original research, and the idea of putting some kind of a book together was probably the first idea I had for a book, but this is my third book, so I felt I needed to get around to it, especially when I walked in the bookstore, and the bookstore said, "We need a book like this." And I looked around, and there hasn't been a book written specifically about Juno this century. So I said, okay, I got to get it done. So I started to work on it over the fall. And I took my experience from writing the two previous books to really take my time and craft a book that I think people will enjoy going back to looking at it again and again. It's not a book that you just read once and put down. If you were to go through each one of the pages, I designed each layout to be separate, to be different. There are conventions in the book that make it easy to follow, but I wanted each turn of the page to be a surprise and to be interesting in its own design and in its own stories and features. And I think that from people who have looked at the book, agreed that that does have that freshness to it. So in that regard, I'm happy with the book and the way that it's laid out.
Who is the book aimed for?
Well, this one definitely is aimed for the commercial tourism market that is, they tell us, is coming up this summer in a big way. But if you read the book, I think that if you're from Juneau, I sent it to some friends who moved off to Texas, and they thoroughly enjoyed it because it covers all of the favorite places in Juneau. The photo aspect of the book does that. I take a look at the title, People Passed in Places, and the places section of the book. I wanted to make sure that all of Juneau was represented. So I made a conscious effort in the design of the book to incorporate all the special areas that people come to know and love being citizens of Juneau. So I wanted somebody who maybe wasn't, who used to live in Juneau, get the book, would go, oh yeah, they didn't forget that place or forget this place. So it's pretty well balanced as far as covering the geographic areas of Juneau, and the history runs from the very beginning of Juneau all the way up to the current times. So I had two directions I was going, geographic and chronologic, to cover it. So a lot to cram into a relatively small book.
It's about 60, 70 pages.
Yes. With 100 pictures. And I maximized all the space. So I think I'm really happy with the way that it came out. And I think people will enjoy it.
With 50,000 pictures that you've taken over the years, how did you make the selections of which ones to include in the book?
Well, that was extremely hard. And probably now that it's published, I should have used this picture, I should have used that picture. So what I've decided to do on my website is to include, put pictures that were not in the book so that people would look at some of the runner-ups and you can decide for yourself whether I made a mistake or should have included certain photographs. But that's what I'm planning to do, is to augment the book with the website, with some of the photos that I collected.
You get a book signing first Friday downtown Hearthside from 4:30 until 7.
Yes, or until there's nobody there left. We'll sign away all night.
Cool. Anything you'd like to add? I might have forgotten to ask.
No, I appreciate you having me and look forward to meeting people on Friday at Hearthside downtown. I'll be there. And I'm counting on the weather to be the same as it is today.
All right, Larry, thanks for coming to the station today.
Thanks, Jeff.
This is Bird Note. Three different birds are singing across a marsh. One bird's voice comes across as a brassy, conkeree. A second sounds like a sneeze. And the third voice has a galloping rhythm. Here are the three again together. See if you can hear the differences. Congratulations! You've just made the essential step in learning how to recognize bird songs. Hearing what's distinctive in one bird's voice compared to another bird's voice. So who are these three marsh birds we've been sorting out? The brassy voice belongs to a red-winged blackbird, a willow flycatcher made that sneezy fitzbew, and the repeated galloping phrases? That's the song of a common yellowthroat. Birds' voices are an invitation. They invite us to get to know the singers better, and for a moment, to step into nature.
side of the hill, there's a place on the hill where the snow it did roll. Well, it rolled down the hill, down the side of the hill. 60 men it did kill, it did kill. Now all the men were buried deep, now they'd sleep in winter sleep. All the men were buried deep, only some were finally freed. A young woman found her man, and she gave all that she had. He was dead, they all said that he was dead. Oh, the lady of the Chilkoot, during gold rushing times, yet one love perseverance, and it was love that saved his life.
Station comes from the Augustus Brown Swimming Pool, located at 1619 Glacier Avenue in downtown Juneau, offering aqua aerobics on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays from 11 a.m. until 12 p.m., and stretch aquatics on Tuesdays and Thursdays from 11 a.m. until 11:45 a.m. Schedules are available online at juneau.org/parkrec/pool. More information at 586-5325.
44 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned to Junior Afternoon here on listener supported KTO and KRNN. Terry Tippett is performing this Saturday night at the Gold Street Music Event, which is at the corner of 10th Street and Glacier Avenue at Resurrection Lutheran Church. Starts at 7:30 in the evening. Performing there will be Trevor Fiscus, Dan and Shaddy DeSlooper, Mark Hurd, Terry Tippett, and Mike Truax. Again, that's Gold Street Music this Saturday at 7:30 at Resurrection Lutheran Church. In the studio with me now is Christy West and Sarah Lynn Tabachnik here to talk about dinner on Saturday night featuring four women of distinction. Christy West is one of those women. Congratulations, Christy.
Thank you, Jeff.
And thank you, Sarah Lynn, for coming down the station.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
So, Christy, you were raised by a single mother of four children. What kind of lessons did those early experiences teach you?
Well, my older sisters and my brother kind of took on helping my mother raise us because she was a provider and parent all in one. And my older two sisters kind of got tired of it by the time they reached puberty. So Mike, my brother, a good old soul, he continued to raise me and kind of show me my reflection of good and bad. But he couldn't do it himself. And luckily, I got into sports, and the coaches and the parents of my teammates kind of stepped in. And I think the lesson I really took from that was that it takes so many adults in a child's life to be able to help them to be successful.
Do you remember if there was a particular activity or sport that really turned you on to the sporting world?
A particular activity or sport? Well, I started running probably when I was about five. It kind of set me free, and everybody approved of me running kind of off by myself. And as I'd get out running, I kind of would get miles under me and become euphoric and kind of just kind of leave the place of whatever troubles I had. And that particular running took me on to soccer. Soccer, it seemed to be something that I'm looking over at Sarah Lynn because we played on opposite teams against each other when we were a little bit younger. And soccer was a sport that really, really worked for me because you got all the running in that you wanted, but it was a team sport, just a really great opportunity. And the competitive nature in me loved the idea of putting the ball in the net.
So when you got out of high school, you started working for the city just about immediately?
Actually for the city I did. When I got out of high school, I went to work cutting trails up at the ski area with the CETA program, with the old federal CETA mm-hmm. program. And I hurt myself, and they put me down at Public Works, and I worked myself into a recreation or a maintenance worker there at Public Works, and really liked blue-collar work, and that's where I started out at, yeah.
Who are some of your early inspirations besides your brother?
Oh, early inspirations. As I said, coaches, and probably one of the most important ones were Mr. and Mrs. Hershey, and they were parents of a teammate that I had in middle school when I first started playing sports. And they realized that I spent a lot of time without supervision, and I think that some of my behaviors were showing that, and they took me under their wing. And so I always had a place to go after school, and Lynn and I became best friends, and they would take me for summer camping trips down the coast of Oregon to Honeyman State Park and just kind of took me under their wing, and they had a horse. And they had me take on the responsibility of taking care of that horse in exchange for riding the horse. So they just showed me some really good things of you put the effort out and you get the rewards for it.
What would you say are the benefits of team and sports in general for a young person?
Oh, so you get your exercise. You hopefully get really good role models as far as coaches go. You see these parents put their time and energy into the program. And, you know, you have this whole building experience with other young people in trying to reach a success together.
Before you returned, you were a manager of the Sangoon Youth Center.
Yes.
Talk to me about that. I know it was one of your favorite jobs.
Oh, yeah, the favorite. I'll never forget. I kind of went over there a little bit begrudgingly because I really liked the position that I was in at Parks and Recreation as a recreation manager overseeing adult and youth sports. And Kim Kiefer had come to me when the job opened up and asked me if I'd go over. And I was real comfortable where I was at. And she said it really wasn't a request. I really want you to go over there. I think you'll like it. So I headed over, and as soon as I walked in the door, you know, you had these youth that had real struggles that they were dealing with, some of them, the teens. I mean, teens in general have struggles, but there we had some, you know, young parents who already had children, that situations were a little bit tough for them in some areas, and it reminded me a lot. I wasn't a teen parent, but I did have a lot of struggles. It reminded me a lot of myself, and I immediately wanted to try and help them out. And God, I mean, they, like I said, they dealt with things that other people just can't even imagine, and they'd still want to finish school. They'd still want to do the best that they could and just persevere. So I was so happy to walk in and be able to work with these extraordinary young people.
Can you talk to me about the importance of family, and your family in particular?
The importance of family. Well, as I said, my siblings really were a lot of who I had to hang out with. We didn't have grandparents that were around, and like I said, my mother was working so hard. And there's one thing I really want to say about my mom, too, that even though she worked so hard and it was absent a lot, she worked two shifts at a restaurant and kind of came in between after school and cooked us meals. She always made sure that I knew that I was loved and that I was the most important person on earth. And I think making sure that we all let people know how important they are and look them in the eye and just validate people as often as we can. I think that's a really important thing, and that's what family does for each other, whether they're relatives or whether they're our Alaska family.
You had two sons, and one of them unfortunately passed away.
Yes.
I believe that you had a great group of people at the Zagorn News Center.
So in 2013, I'd had a real devastating blow, lost my son Nels to a tragedy. And I took some time off, a few months off, and realize how lonely I was without the Zach Gordon teens. And so I came back to work, and they were absolutely amazing. They were absolutely loving and understanding. And because they'd had so much trauma in their lives, a lot of them, they understood that really probably the best medicine for me was to come in and sit with me and just be a comfort and be there with me. And my chair was almost never empty in the afternoon. Once the kids got out of school, somebody would come in and sit and just stay there with me as I got through the rest of my day. And I couldn't have healed as well as I did without that influence.
And you're retired now, but you still keep a busy schedule.
Yeah, I do. I've kind of taken some time to rejuvenate, and I'm spending a lot of time hiking. And my husband and I, Kurt, built a log cabin just a couple years ago, and there's still a lot of work to be done on that. And recently I got involved with volunteering with Girls on the Run and Heart and Soul, and was at both of those practices the last couple of days. And I'm just getting the most out of it again, getting back with volunteering with youth.
And when you get honored like you are in the Women of Distinction program, you must know something. What kind of advice would you give to other people?
I think going back to always just making sure that we connect with people in a friendly and supportive manner. Anything that we can do to help a child to succeed, just do it and be friendly. They have a big smile because it's so much easier and it goes a long way, and especially in the eyes of a child.
You're one of four Women of Distinction this year, and there's a Saturday night dinner party to celebrate you and the other women.
Yes.
Carolyn, you want to tell me what's on the menu for Saturday night?
On the menu? Well, let me just tell you, Abby's Kitchen is the caterer.
Need we say more?
And exactly. We're pretty excited, of course, to honor Christy. We're also honoring Missouri Smythe, Marie Darlin, and Justine Munch. And the doors open at 5:30 at Centennial Hall. For the first hour and a half, we have silent auction and a no-host bar. And then at 7 o'clock, the program begins. And the highlight of the program, the highlight of the evening, is when each of the women speaks for about 7 minutes about what inspires her, what brought her to where she is today. And, you know, I have the honor of sitting here with you, Jeff, and honor one of the women we're honoring day after day, and it's very moving to me. You know, so often we have an audience in tears, but it's very heartwarming. It's, you know, I've known Christy a little bit out and about in town, and then she's honored for this event and nominated, and then I learned so much more than I ever knew. And it's really a gift to the community and to AWARE. So we're delighted to be honoring Christy this year.
What time is the dinner starting? Doors open?
Program starts at 7, 5:30 to 7. We'll have Rob Cohen and his trio playing some music. And then at 7 o'clock, the program begins.
Christy West and Sherilyn Tabachnik, thank you so much for coming in today. Is there anything you'd like to add about it I forgot to ask?
Thank you, Jeff, for having us. Thank you.
Arts of 360 presents another episode of Alaska Originals featuring Harm. Harm is a Fairbanks-based psych folk ensemble that will be bringing you an hour of original music and poetry at KTOO on Saturday, March 5th at 7 p.m. Tickets are online at harmalaska.com.
When she smiles, I try to catch it even when my eyes glow.
Well, the forecast for tonight looks like mostly clear skies.
Is humankind.
This is KTOO Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown.